the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Pope Francis welcomed President Donald Trump to the Vatican this week, and the First Lady, Melania, confirmed that she is Catholic. It was a historic and eagerly anticipated meeting, and of course, Pope Francis continues to surprise everyone by naming five new members of the College of Cardinals from all the far corners of the world. That and more this week on Register Radio. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host for Register Radio.
And I'm Matthew Bunsen, the Register's Senior Editor.
This week, we talk about Pope Francis's meeting with President Trump. We talk a little bit about the First Lady and this new information that we have about her faith. And of course, we also get to talk about new cardinals. It's a busy week for Vatican watchers and presidential historians.
Well, in that sense, we're going to talk with the Register contributor, Dr. Paul Kangor, about the meeting between President Trump and Pope Francis, as well as the secular media's take on that same meeting. It was a variety of different universes, depending upon who you talk to.
That's absolutely right. And, of course, Edward Penton was there for part of this historic event. And, Edward, we're glad to have you on Register Radio.
Thanks. Good to be with you again.
So, Edward, first of all, why don't we find out what you did see in person, and then we'll talk a little bit about your assessment of the meeting.
Sure. Well, I wasn't actually in the pool for the actual meeting. There are only two journalists allowed, and they took the main agencies for that. But I did see them arrive, and they were given a very warm welcome. They were very respectful in the way that they greeted the Pope. They were dressed in all the correct attire. Melania, of course, wore black with a mantilla, and it was all very, very well done. They were very, very pleased to see him. And as we know, or listeners probably know, President Trump was very, very pleased with the meeting. He called it fantastic, and he was just very grateful, I think, for it. And I think for the Pope and the Vatican, it went well too. I think they got the points they wanted to get across to the president, and there was a lot of common ground in many ways, especially on the pro-life issues, on religious freedom, and also I think they found a way forward on immigration and those rather difficult subjects where there's been differences, also on the environment, although the environment, interestingly, wasn't mentioned in the final statement, but I believe it was discussed with Cardinal Parolin after the meeting with the Holy Father.
And what do you think was the main... I guess the main message coming from this meeting?
Well, I think it was really putting behind all the problems, the rather public problems that there have been in the past regarding immigration and so forth. As listeners will know, there was certain problems there with when the Pope came back from Mexico last year, and then he said something again later last year about the wall and his problems with the wall on the border of Mexico. And that, I think, has probably been smoothed over. And I think that's probably the thing that's come out of this. There's been a certain meeting of minds, and there's been a... I think, certainly as far as the Vatican's concerned, they're very pleased, I think, with what the president has done with on the pro-life issue. I think they find he's made a great start there. Obviously, they're a bit cautious about how that's going to continue. But they are very keen on that, and that the president continues on that, obviously in contrast to President Obama, who was quite the opposite on that score. So there's certain encouragement there, and I think they were very pleased with the way they handled themselves, and that they were very respectful when they came to meet the Pope and all the rest in the Holy See.
Yeah, Edward, the communique from the Secretary of State used words like cordial and serene, which, of course, is always diplomatic speech for things went well.
Yes.
From your perspective, from the body language that you were seeing from Vatican officials, it sounds like they were pleased. But what exactly is the Vatican hoping from this meeting? What would they like to see the United States be doing from the Vatican's perspective?
Well, I think they obviously on the pro-life things, they would like that to continue. But on the immigration side, they want to see more, on the policy side there, to be more open and accepting of migrants. I think they they don't really like the rhetoric coming from the White House on that. And I also think on the environment too, they're not happy with the administration's position on climate change, on the Paris agreement, and they want that they want the U.S. to be more involved in that. They're not pushing that in a huge way. They're just trying to make sure that that these things are open for discussion. There's room for discussion in the future. I think they're just hopeful that there's going to be continued diplomatic activity on all these fronts. But as always with these meetings, there's always a lot of hype, but actually there's not a lot to go on. We just have to wait and see how these continue.
That's right. That's right. So the press has talked a bit about Catholics who were not able to join Trump. So Catholics from his administration, and some people have made an ado about Sean Spicer not being on this trip. And of course, he's the chief or the primary spokesperson for President Trump, and there were a couple other Catholics, high-level Catholics, who weren't on this trip. But the very interesting thing is that out of this trip, we find that Melania Trump is Catholic. So what's the story?
Mm. Yes, well, as far as I heard from a source I know in the administration, that there's a lot of work that they're having to do, and so there's quite a few members of the administration who didn't come to the Vatican because they're doing other work. So they had other things to do, which were very important. But I think as far as Melania Trump is concerned, that was a surprise, because I think a lot of people thought that she wasn't actually a practicing Catholic, even though she was born within, a Catholic family who kept their faith very quiet because of the communist regime in Slovenia. And so nobody was quite sure whether she was or not. But her spokesman says that she is, and she does take her faith seriously. And it was interesting, actually, during the meeting, during the visit, that she went to visit the children's hospital near the Vatican, the Vatican-run children's hospital. And she did several things which showed very much how much she takes the faith seriously. She laid flowers at the foot of a statue of Our Lady. She actually said before she went in she wanted time to pray. Before she arrived there, she said to her staff she wanted time alone to pray in the chapel, which she did, and had her own personal rosary beads blessed by the Holy Father and so forth. So it was all very much, faith was very much a part of this for her, and I think she was very honored and felt it was a great privilege, of course, to go and see the Holy Father.
And Edward, of course, all of this overshadowed the announcement made by Pope Francis on Sunday that he was going to name 5 new cardinals to the College of Cardinals, which brings us to, 121 cardinals, one over the limit. What's your immediate take on these new members of the college?
Well, it's very much in keeping with Pope Francis's attitude towards the college so far, about bringing in bishops who are on the periphery, who've never been. There's never been a cardinal in their diocese before, and that's very much in keeping with that. It's all about trying to expand the university of the church. But I think also what's interesting about these choices is that not only are they from the periphery, but they're also involved either with peace or with helping the poor. Bishop in Mali has been very important in trying to reach out to Muslims, because it's a very strong Muslim population there, and they've had trouble with Islamist terrorism there. Mm-hmm. And then you've got, even in Barcelona, which has been traditionally a cardinalatial see, the bishop there has been a missionary for many years in Africa. So all the time he's reaching out to those, he's picking those who are very much on the periphery. So it seems to be very consistent with his choices so far.
Matthew, you tend to follow this, the cardinals quite closely, and you're working on detailing the bios of these new cardinals. Which ones surprised you?
Well, the most surprising was the pick from El Salvador. Gregorio Rosa Chavez, who is, in an unprecedented fashion, an auxiliary bishop in San Salvador. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, he's not even head of his own see. But the backstory to him is that he was a friend of Blessed Oscar Romero, and in fact has dedicated his red hat, as they say, to Romero. The other surprising one, of course, is Anders Arborelius, who's the bishop of in Sweden, who leads a still tiny flock, but who had a very prominent role last year in the fall in greeting and welcoming Pope Francis to Sweden for the start of the commemoration of the 500th anniversary of the start of the Protestant Reformation. So these are unusual picks, to be sure.
Well, they're interesting picks, and we're looking forward to the coverage from both of you, a little bit more detail about who these cardinals are. Of course, the cardinals, the body of cardinals, are the ones who elect the next pope. And so we put a lot of importance in these churchmen, and we have to pray for them. So thank you both for covering them. And again, like I said, we look forward to hearing more about them. Edward, thanks for joining us from Rome, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks. Good to speak with you.
So take a look at Edward Penton's blogspot at ncregister.com for more updates on all of this news from Rome. He keeps that blogspot going quite steadily, so you'll enjoy what Edward has to report on. When we come back, we will be joined by Paul Kengor. He's an author, and he's also professor of political philosophy at Grove City College. He's going to give us his historian's perspective about the Trump-Francis meeting. This is Register Radio on EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. More when we return.
Marriage. If you forget the love story, what are you left with? Rules, regulations, obligations? You're left with a really bad idea. But in the context of love, all the sacrifices and rules and regulations make perfect sense. Faith is kind of like that. Pope Francis recently said, "We are in the midst of a love story, and if we don't understand that, we've understood nothing of what the Church is." Much of the world perceives Catholicism as a list of rules, regulations, and rituals that have nothing to do with real life. And we wonder why they're not interested? Friends, the Catholic faith is a love story. We're brought into this world through an act of love. All our lives we're looking for love, but no love in this life fully satisfies. That's because the God who is love made us for the love that is God. And when we strayed from Him, He died on a cross to save us. That's how much He loves us. That's what all this is about. And that's what the world needs to be reminded of more than ever. This is Chris Stefanik from RealLifeCatholic.com on EWTN Radio.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back to Register Radio. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register, and I'm joined by Matthew Bunsen and Paul Kengor. Paul is a professor of political science, and he's the executive director for the Center of Vision and Values at Grove City College. His forthcoming book, or actually it's out now, sorry, his book is A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century. Paul, welcome back to Register Radio.
Thank you, Jeanette. It's great. I'm actually here in the studio with Matthew in Washington, so this is a new experience.
It's so great to have you in that setting because it just makes you sound so close to me in Birmingham.
Right. Yeah. Actually, we're all in the same room, right?
Right.
The three of us.
And it seems appropriate that we're talking about the president and the Pope meeting because here before us, through the glass, you can see the nation's capital.
That's right. And it looks like it's going to storm. I don't know if that has anything to do with it. I don't know if that's an omen or what.
Well, the meeting of the President Trump and Pope Francis certainly wasn't a storm. As Matthew said in our last segment, the press release talked about it being cordial and serene, and that is certainly not what the media drummed it up to be in advance, was it?
No, it wasn't, Jeanette. I mean, the media was hoping for fireworks. I mean, they were hoping for acrimony and maybe a lecture from Pope Francis, maybe telling Donald Trump something about building walls. And, you know, they were hoping for a little bit of a fight. And I, you know, frankly, I didn't expect that because of the nature of the Holy Father and what he's like. He talks about mercy. He is about mercy. He's very winsome. He's very friendly. He's very kind. And Donald Trump, I mean, look, I knew that Pope Francis would treat Trump well. I figured he would. I expected he would. And Donald Trump responds nicely to people who are nice to him.
Exactly.
if he would have treated him not quite as nicely and not such a friendly manner, then maybe Trump would have went straight to his Twitter account, and who knows what would have come from that. But he treated him well, and Trump responded in kind. And I there's some very touching moments there, including the phrase from Trump where he said, and it was the CNN headline the next morning at CNN.com, if I have it right, he told the Holy Father, "I won't forget what you told me."
Right.
Which is a really interesting thing to say. And I don't know, Matthew, if we know what exactly he's referring to.
That's exactly right. We don't really know. We have a pretty good idea of some of the topics they discussed. We know there is religious liberty. We know that there is peace, obviously. This is a big priority for the president, having just gone to Riyadh and then to Jerusalem to try to build peace. But whatever it was that Francis said, it certainly left an impression on the president, didn't it?
It did. And he also gave him three papal statements, encyclicals, Laudato Si as well. And Trump said he would read them. And you know, that
every president seems to say that.
Right. But, you know, Trump is, by his own admission, not a reader. He says he doesn't read books. He almost boasts about it in a really strange way. But you know, Laudato Si, I think, is it's about 50 to 75 pages,
yeah,
maybe,
about
something like that. So it is not necessarily book length, but it's a lengthy statement. And so if he were to sit down and read any of those documents, I think that would be great. It's a wonderful step. And, you know, one thing that we know about meetings with popes by presidents is it affects them. It always influences the president. It always seems to have some kind of an effect. And I think Donald Trump, even with a person of ego that he is, mm-hmm. walking into that environment of St. Peter's Basilica. And I mean, I've talked to many of my students who are not Catholic who told me about walking into St. Peter's for the first time and crying, being overwhelmed by it. So I think that environment really, really positively affected Trump.
And there was that almost an iconic image now of the president and the first lady standing in the Sistine Chapel beneath the gaze of The Last Judgment by Michelangelo.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it really is amazing. I think of Mikhail Gorbachev when he first went in. Mikhail and Ryeza Gorbachev. Ryeza was an atheist. Gorbachev, probably not. He's a little harder to figure out. But he talked about going in and his legs shaking. Mm-hmm. I mean, really just having this sense of awe. So for Donald Trump, and I think also the visuals of Melania and Ivanka,
right,
with the veil or their head, right, covered partly, I mean, that was nice to see. I think for the entire Trump family, crew, it looked like it was a special moment.
Well, as somebody who has followed the relationships of presidents and popes over the years, what do you think that the president was hoping to get most out of this meeting?
Well, it's a good question. And the contrast with Reagan and John Paul II, almost 35 years to the week that they first met. They first met June 1982 at the Vatican. They went in with such a single unity of mind and mission. They both had survived assassination attempts the previous year. They already were, as Frank Shakespeare, the second ambassador to the Vatican, called them, kindred spirits, mm-hmm. kindred souls. I mean, they agreed on economics, on their views of the world, on human life. So they went in with so many commonalities of ideas, even to some degree ideology, even some faith commonalities, and worldview as well. With these two, you don't have that. So, I mean, it almost seemed, and I was doing this the week up until the meeting, trying to figure out, okay, let me write down on paper, you know, where do they agree? Okay, here are 10 things that Trump finds important. Here are 10 things that Francis finds important. And so I think they found the intersection with religious liberty, religious persecution, not just in the Middle East, in places like Syria, but also here in the United States,
yeah,
with the protection that Donald Trump is offering through Supreme Court picks or executive orders or legislation of the likes of the Little Sisters of the Poor. Pope Francis has got to like that.
And the Vatican has to be very happy with this administration's approach to the whole life issue.
Right. One of the first things, I think it might have been day one, that President Trump did was sign the executive order banning U.S. funding of Planned Parenthood International.
Mm-hmm.
So that must please the Holy Father. And also, Pope Francis had to be impressed that, look, a president's first foreign trip is a big deal.
Right.
And those have, it's not just a matter of reacting to the news of the day. It has symbolic importance. For him to pick the Holy Land, Saudi Arabia, and, you know, which is the home of Mecca of all things, and also to pick the Vatican, that had to have pleased the Holy Father.
You know, it's funny. We at the Register, in some of our meetings this week, our editorial meetings, were sort of tooting our own horn internally because we had an editorial last week that really just framed this, I think, in many ways as it has gone.
I agree totally.
Yeah,
yes.
With the same issues that were, you know, present at the table, and with the same cordiality and respect for each other that we saw.
That editorial nailed it. It really did. I mean, I read that, and I thought, I read that at a time, Jeanette, when I was struggling a little bit to think, where are these two guys going to find common ground? and I mean, I read that editorial, and I thought somebody should literally get this to President Trump's handlers.
That's awesome.
Because this is it. And I think that if there was anything close to a script that they followed, that was it. If you read the Vatican statement on the meeting, which Matthew was very short, maybe 100, 200 words,
yeah,
it hit on precisely those issues.
Right. We left out the words cordial and serene, though.
Right, you did. You left those out.
We did. We left them out, but we had a feeling that's what it would be like. So really, there's something else I wanted to talk about because it happened on your turf, and that is Vice President Mike Pence at Grove City College, and he was there for commencement, right? Just last week.
That's right. He was our commencement speaker. That would have been May 20th. It was a Saturday. And he was great. He was really good. He was his usual just very decent, gracious self. He's a nice guy. Mm-hmm. He comes off as a nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, a lot of I've talked to students over the years. I've been at Grove City College now for about 20 years. They usually remember the commencement speaker, but they don't usually remember what he said,
uh-huh,
right? And I think that's true for a lot of people.
Right.
With commencement, but and it may even be true with Pence, because he gave, this is not a criticism, but he gave sort of a standard statement about 15, 20 minutes. But the thing that no one will ever forget, Jeanette, and I'm glad to say this on national radio, he stood there, Mike Pence, after he gave his speech and shook the hands of every single
really?
One. Yes, of our 600-plus students. I've never seen a commencement speaker do that before.
Okay,
I mean, we've had great ones, gracious ones. They've given a nice speech. They stay up at the podium. They usually talk to our chairman of the board while the students walk by, shake the hands of the president of the college, that is. This time they went up, they shake the hand of our college president, Paul McNulty, and then Mike Pence, who was right next to him. Every single one of those students, he shook hands with them.
What was the reaction of some of the students to that?
They loved it. And Pence got at least two standing ovations, including when he was first mentioned by name, when our president welcomed him. We had, I think there were a couple students who didn't shake his hand. So
yeah.
I want to note that, especially given what happened in Notre Dame.
Right.
The way that Pence, I don't know how many walked out, dozens maybe.
Yes, why I brought this up, because there are people who are protesting the speaker, and I think that says the vice president, you know, and any speaker, they protest them all. It seems like these days, but. What does that say about college students? What does it say about college campuses and, I mean, even your own campus, which is a rather conservative place?
Well, I think it shows how intolerant they are as they claim tolerance, uh-huh, ironically. It's the same people that are claiming tolerance and diversity. And once again, it's tolerance and diversity for me, but not for thee. And I especially note that tolerance point because most of these protesters are coming from the LGBTQ point of view.
Mm-hmm.
They're not protesting Pence's or Trump's stance on Israel or even immigration. I mean, most of it comes down to these sexual moral issues. Mm-hmm. The LGBTQ issues. I think that probably is what was motivating the Notre Dame students as well, who walked out.
Well, Paul, you know, we're following these kind of issues, you know, the dialogue on college campuses or the lack of dialogue. And so this was a really important thing for me to talk with you about. And I'm grateful that you were there and you saw it and you could give us that perspective. So thanks for, you know, thanks for bringing that to the table and helping us to see that it is intolerant that we're seeing here in the name of tolerance.
Well, it's intolerant, and I mean, if I could use a harsh word, I think it was kind of obnoxious. Mm-hmm. It really was. I mean, it is. Imagine, you know, your child walking past the vice president who's got his hand out. After shaking the hands of 300 others, and she kind of pulls her hand back and struts right past him because she doesn't like his position on marriage.
Yeah.
I mean, it's rude. It's very, very rude. And imagine if you're at Notre Dame, your child being among dozens or maybe as high as 100 who just got up and walked out. And after Notre Dame gave an honorary degree to Barack Obama in 2009.
Right.
So, I mean, if Notre Dame, I mean, there's clearly balance there on that part, on their part. And they didn't invite Donald Trump. They invited Mike Pence. I can understand that a lot of the students don't like Trump. I know that. And Mike Pence is also the governor of the state of Indiana. He was the governor of the state of Indiana.
Well, and you had that famous line from one of the students at Notre Dame, I think it was, who, as he was walking away, said, based on the vice president's words, he felt threatened.
Mm. Yes, yes.
Well, there's we're done with the show, the on-air part of the show, but we can continue to talk for our podcast because there's still a lot more of this conversation that can be had. And I'm going to return for a second, Paul, because I want to get your thoughts on the Trump administration and I guess the personnel issues that seem to be forever in the media's conversation. And it is this... an administration on the rocks, if you will, this early on. And that's something I wanted to pose to you because you've watched quite a few presidents and you, as a historian, can probably give us a bit of some context on what's happening.
Oh, sure, Jeanette. Yeah, this has been a very rocky start. And to have as many people come in and then leave already as has had happened, including with the National Security Advisor, basically before the administration even got up and running. I mean, that's just stunning to see that. And in fact, Ronald Reagan had 6 or 7 National Security Advisors, which was a record.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Trump, you wonder if he's headed for that in the first couple of years. That has been really striking. And also, too, there's a huge number of positions in the major positions in the federal government that have not been filled yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really not being talked about much, but they've got a lot of work to do.
And how much of these the situation regarding these unfilled positions, is it the administration or is it the process on Capitol Hill in which the one party's trying to drag its feet a bit?
It might be a little bit of both, and I think too possibly it could be that certain traditional conservatives and Republicans that you would expect to work in a Republican administration are not that eager to jump in. They don't exactly know what's going to happen. You turn on CNN or Fox or MSNBC at any time, and it's Russia, Russia, Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And you know nowadays, too, they're even throwing around the word impeachment.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people don't want to come in just the opening months of what they think might be a sinking ship or a failed presidency. In fact, to connect this to Mike Pence, we had some of the people at my conservative Christian college joking, calling him among ourselves the soon-to-be President Pence. and you know, that's how much the thought of Trump not lasting was in the air, even at a place where a place that was not a liberal college.
Well, you've raised the names of several major news organizations. As somebody who's covered presidents for a long time, have you ever seen this sort of approach to a new administration? I know that Ronald Reagan was not very popular. George W. wasn't very popular.
Yeah, and the press was ferocious to Ronald Reagan and also to George W. Bush, especially to George W. Bush. I mean, those after the invasion of Iraq in 2003, there a period from about 2003 to 2007. It's almost hard to imagine looking back that he was able to get reelected with a higher percentage of the vote and higher number of the vote as he did in 2004. But they went after him like a pack of wolves. But with I'd have to say that in Trump's case, it does seem different.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember such hostility so early on. I mean, remember the Women's March here in Washington that took place the day after the inauguration. I mean, they were ready to go. And it seems like every new event, May Day, which, you know, May Day sometimes gets acknowledged on the fringes by people who are pretty far to the left. But this year they were gearing up for their largest May Day march on Washington in decades. So that, you know, that's all because of this really powerful, palpable hostility toward Donald Trump.
What's the basis for this hostility?
Well, with I think it begins with November 4th, right? I think that was the date of the election. And to have somebody, and I would encourage Trump supporters to really think about this, have some empathy for this point of view because it's a good point. I mean, imagine you're a liberal Democrat and Hillary Clinton is going to be your president and it's going to be the first female president. For them, she's like Eleanor Roosevelt reincarnated, right? And even more than that, because she supports abortion and so forth, which is such a big issue to them. And she gets 3 million more votes than Donald Trump. I mean, 3 million more votes. She took the overall popular vote by about 2.1%. And to give you an idea of how much of a vote difference 3 million is, George H.W. Bush, when he won the Electoral College but lost the popular vote to Al Gore, that difference was about 540,000 votes. Mm. So this was 5-6 times that.
Right.
So he, you know, she arguably crushed him and lost.
doesn't hurt that she carried California by about 3.5 million votes.
She did. I mean, she carried California, but I mean, that's going to be. That was the same for Mitt Romney in 2012, right? Mitt Romney lost California that bad. George W. Bush lost it that bad. And I mean, if I know that a lot of Trump supporters will say, well, if you remove California from her column, yeah, but okay, then let's remove Texas from Trump's column. So it all adds up. And Trump said, well, if this was an non-electoral college contest, but the total vote, I would have campaigned differently. Well, so would she.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, she would have campaigned in the South.
She might have actually gone to Wisconsin.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So I think, Jeanette, that it and Matthew, it starts with that. They are seething,
still
angry,
right, of course,
that they lost when they feel like they didn't really lose.
Is there something too about the personality of Donald Trump that just seems to get under their skin?
Oh, absolutely. It got under my skin. It still does. Mm-hmm. I mean, I probably shouldn't say exactly who I voted for and what I did in the last election, but I mean, I was out there very vocally, completely against Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this is an interesting development. A lot of the young women that I know, and I won't say which college it is, but I spoke at a very devout Catholic college about a month ago, went out to dinner with a group of about a half dozen young women, two young men in the group, a couple of professors, and these girls were all really conservative, really pro-life. Not one of them voted for Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. They loved Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz. They would have taken John Kay, almost any of these folks. I have female students, my student assistant who ran the College Republicans group on campus, she stepped aside when Trump got the nomination.
Yeah.
Basically didn't want to campaign for him. They are without a party, kind of. They are not liberals. They're not going to become Democrats. They would have never voted for Hillary Clinton, and they didn't vote for Hillary Clinton, but they can't believe that their parents, who taught them about virtue and morality in politics, or, you know, who complained about what a lout Bill Clinton was in the 1990s, would suddenly tell them that, you know, they're failing in their moral responsibility if they don't cast a vote for Donald Trump against Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. A lot of these young women are saying, I can't vote for that guy. I mean, you know, this guy is an ogre in their view. And so they can't.
Which makes even more mystifying, in a way, the fact that Hillary Clinton lost the white women vote.
Mm-hmm. It does. And I often tell my liberal friends, if you're so mad about Trump winning, you shouldn't have run Hillary Clinton. I think really Donald Trump was the only of the nominees that of the Republican nominees who wouldn't beat Hillary in the popular vote. In fact, I carry around in my briefcase a little National Catholic Register article from about a year ago that had survey data. I really do. That had, because I use this stuff,
Paul,
a lot.
I love you.
I have it at my fingertips, and it showed the different Republican candidates and how they stacked up against Hillary Clinton. And Marco Rubio crushed her.
Right.
John Kasich, I think, was second. He beat her by about 10. Chris Christie beat her. Ted Cruz, the other Bush, Jeb Bush.
Jeb, yeah.
The only one who lost to her was Trump. And he was losing to her then by like 10 or 15 points.
Right.
It's amazing he got as close as he did. So, I mean, that's – so I would tell my liberal friends, you should have nominated Hillary Clinton. She's probably the only person that could have been defeated by Donald Trump. So think about that. I knew lifelong Republicans who said, hey, if the Democrats had run a pro-life Democrat this time, I might have voted for that person.
Right.
But they'll never do that.
Well, it's a really an amazing moment for our country. It's a strange moment. We see some good happening, and we've got to support that good, especially on the pro-life front, on the religious liberty front. We've really got to push him more on the religious liberty front. And of course, the most important thing we can do at this moment is to get involved, I think, in the local level, you know, and make sure that we are letting our own Congress people know where we stand on both of those issues, so that the future we are left with a much greater options, much better options. So, Paul, as always, it's always a lot of fun to talk with you. Thanks for being on Register Radio.
Oh, thank you, Jeanette. It's always good talking to you guys.
We really appreciate your contributions.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate what you guys do.
Remember, for more news and analysis, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us on Register Radio here on EWTN. For Matthew Bunsen and our producer, Rich Jesse, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next time, God bless.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.